Testing 1, 2, 3. Hello, testing 1, 2, 3. This is Sam talking. 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I think I missed some numbers there. Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner. It is Thursday, May 31st, 2012. I'm Sam Minter, and once again, Yvonne Bo is not with us this week. So this makes 3 weeks in a row with just me. I am so sorry. I know that sucks, but that's just the way it worked out. Different things came up each of the 3 weeks, really. This last week, both Yvonne and I were traveling. I'm still traveling. I'll have some things to say about that in a bit. Next week's show should be back to normal with both me and Yvonne talking about the events of the day and tech news and whatever else is going on. In the meantime, though, a couple things to talk about. One, the reason I'm traveling was my little sister's graduation from college with her bachelor's. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that, and I'll do the sort of, you know, sappy sort of, oh, wow, look how she's grown up kind of thing for just a little bit. You know, probably not really that much interesting to everybody in the world, but what the hell, I'm going to do it anyway. My trip home has been not quite smooth, so I'll talk about that a little bit. I'm still not home, actually. I'm recording this from a hotel room. We'll see how it goes. Was a couple other topics to potentially talk about. We've got what's going on in Syria. We've got Romney finally getting to 1144. Kind of anticlimactic, but it happened, and maybe we should note it. The proposal for a ban in New York City of large sugary drinks. Anyway, that's the potential agenda. So let's get started. I promise not to take too long on this, but I do just want to talk a little bit about traveling to my sister's graduation. So for those of you who don't know, there's a 19-year age difference between my sister and I. I graduated a long time ago, 19 years ago, and now it's her turn. This is one of the, it's not quite the same as having a child graduate. It's not quite the same as having a sister or brother who's only a year or two graduate. But it's one of those things that has you thinking, wow, where did all the time go? I remember when, you know, she was a baby, when she was a toddler, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it's just amazing to watch those milestones roll by. In the case of my sister, I spent a lot of time with her when she was a child, before, you know, age 10, 12, and then I kind of moved away, and I regret not having as much contact with her as during her teenage years. Not that a teenager would want contact like that, you know, they pull away from all the older folks and concentrate on their peer group, and that's normal. But anyway, I moved away, so it was just, it happened, of course. She's very accomplished. Her entire career has been, you know, one of amazing amounts of discipline and getting things done and good grades and all this kind of stuff. I was always the kid who, you know, other people would acknowledge or sort of or go to for homework help, or I would, of course, you know, people would be like, well, of course Sam knows that, you know, Sam understands, ask him for help or whatever. But my grades were always just, my entire school career, basically from elementary school through the last classes I took in college, I basically consistently had like a 3.3 grade point average. You know, some A's, some B's, very rare C. I think maybe in college I got less than a C once on a class I kind of blew off. Get A's on the tests and things like that, but pretty much blow off the homework and not do it except when it was really required, and do things at the last moment and blah, blah, blah. That was me. My sister, entirely different, very much the conscientious student type who would make everything, do everything that was required to be done, do it all excellently, work her ass off at all times. I think she finally relaxed a little bit towards the end of college, but very impressive. She's moving on to vet school to become a veterinarian after this, and so she'll start that in the fall. So I just wanted to say congratulations to my sister Cynthia. It was great to come out to the graduation and spend time with her and my dad and my stepmom and my step-grandfather as well. That was a hoot. Anyway, time moves on, I guess. I guess it's only a matter of time until I'm having these same kinds of things about my daughter or my son or who knows, and it just emphasizes that, the inevitable march of progress in history, I guess. Anyway, let me transition quickly into my travel stuff. And I won't spend too much time on this. The first segment will be these two things, and then we'll move on to other issues. But the graduation was Monday. Plan was to fly out Tuesday. So, and I had to be taken to the airport because that's when the ride was available, Tuesday morning, even though my flights were Tuesday afternoon. So I get to the airport Tuesday morning. I'm hanging out. Oh, and then, about an hour and a half before it's finally time for my flight, flight canceled. So they booked me on the next flight, and the flight was canceled because of weather. It was flying, my sister graduated from Oberlin College, and the closest airport is Cleveland. There's a commuter flight that goes back and forth between Philadelphia and Cleveland. Philadelphia was my connection city. You don't care. Why am I getting this level of detail? Anyway, the flight was delayed, or canceled. So they booked me on the next one. That was canceled too. It was all weather related. At that point, there was no other way out of Cleveland for the day. So I ended up at a hotel. And since it was weather related, hotel on my own dime. Next morning, I come in. The flight's delayed. Actually, they called me at 1 in the morning to let me know the flight would be delayed. And then it was delayed again and again. And eventually, that flight did get out. But not in time to make any connections. So my trip home to Seattle was not going to happen, and it was time to stay overnight at another hotel. This time, the airline paid for it. But and that's where I am now. I'm at a hotel in Philadelphia awaiting my afternoon flight finally back to Seattle. It'll be about 48 hours late by the time I actually get to Seattle, 48 hours after I was originally planned to get there, slightly less, but whatever. Anyway, I've had a couple people say things like, I'm so sorry, I can't believe you've been through all this trouble, that's awful, I wish you didn't, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, look, this is what makes travel interesting. Now, don't get me wrong, I would love to be home. I miss my family. They're apparently going nuts without me. Ha. Yeah. I video chat with my son every night or whatever, and my wife. And, it's like, when's daddy coming home? I understand. I don't get me wrong. I wish I was home. However, travel where everything goes right is boring. The interesting part is when things go other than what's planned, and you have to adapt, and you have to change, and you have to mess around. This isn't like a super exciting thing. I got to stay in a couple of hotels. Very, generic. It's a hotel. It's got two beds. It's got whatever. it's not like some of my random trips of the distant past where I ended up having to pitch a tent in the middle of nowhere because I got my truck stuck in the mud, or where I was traveling specifically with having made no plans whatsoever for where I would stay each night. So I'm wandering around looking for a hotel with vacancy. It's not that much fun. But, you know, it's a little something, a little something. Anyway, here I am. We'll see if I actually get home tonight. Hopefully. Okay, and with that, let's take a break. We'll be back and talk about some issues that are less specific to me. Back after this exciting, exciting message. And I'm back. In the meantime, right after I recorded the last segment, they brought me my my hotel room service breakfast thing, and I had breakfast. It was yummy. Anyway, let's talk about something else. Let's do Syria next. You know, and this is going to sound like a repeat of every time I've talked about Syria previously, with or without Yvonne. Which is, oh my gosh, it's awful, it's horrible, but what the hell can we do? A few things to point out. The new news this week was obviously there was video put out of a massacre where, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but roughly 100 people were killed, and roughly half of them were children, and there was video put out of a number of the dead children lying on the floor after this massacre. And, you know, it's heart-wrenching, of course, because, you know, here they're, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5-year-olds, you know, young kids, killed in various ways, and you read the stories about it. Some of it was through shelling. Some of it was through people actually going, you know, house to house, killing people with knives and guns. And you look at that kind of thing and you just can't help but be emotionally affected and be like, something must be done. But then, I don't want to minimize that, and I don't want to minimize that in any way. But I do want to point out how incredibly inconsistent we are about those things. There are killings that go on of similar... First of all, let's just talk Syria itself. There was... The video is what makes the difference here. There have been horrific killings of civilians going on for the last year, including plenty of children. In other parts of the world, there have been similar scale events over the last few years. I'm not going to try to remember and name them, and I'm not fully aware of all of them either, but this kind of thing, unfortunately, is not super, super unusual. I mean, maybe it's much more unusual than it used to be, but it's still, it happens. And for that matter, if you're worried about killing innocent kids, you know, are drone strikes in Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan have killed plenty of innocent kids along with whoever we were targeting, which maybe there is or is not justification for the folks we were actually targeting, but plenty of collateral damage. So yes, this is horrible. But there's plenty of other horrible stuff going on too. And maybe it would be nice to have a little consistency in our response and maybe, you know, pay attention to more of the horrible events. But having said that, then this is the, oh, we must do something. And like I said, maybe it would be nice if we said, oh, we must do something for more of these type events. But what is there really that can be done here? You've got folks like John McCain calling for military strikes in Syria. You've got people calling for arming the rebels. You've got people calling for no-fly zones. And while all of these things seem potentially well-intentioned, it's really hard to see how any of them would result in anything other than more people getting killed. There was, for those of you who don't already know about this, there's another podcast I listen to called Hardcore History by Dan Carlin. I would actually recommend it highly. There's a one of the recent episodes was on the Blitz in World War II. But more generally, it was about the effects of war on civilians and how our standards have been changing over time. And how, you know, as recently as World War II, which is within the memory of many people still living today. You know, I mentioned I was at my sister's graduation and I spent time with my step-grandfather. He served in World War II. As recently as World War II, the concept of all-out war, including attacks on civilians, was fairly well accepted. It's just part of how war was done. We had massive firebombings on many cities in both Japan and Europe that killed many more people than the nuclear bombs did. But anyway, I'm getting off track. Back to Syria. All of the interventions that people are talking about seem like in the end they just result in more violence. And I would be happy, you know, for someone to suggest something that seemed like it really had a good shot at working without in a way that actually reduced the amount of death and violence on the ground rather than increased it. And, you know, I'd probably be for such an intervention. And I don't know, maybe a targeted attack on the head of the Syrian government. I don't know. But, you know, just starting to send up, for instance, a safe zone for the rebels. Well, that just makes it so that they have a stronger base from which to launch attacks on the other side. And that has a result of prolonging the war and the conflict. So does that help? I don't know. Maybe if, and this gets into what the real goal is. Is the goal to overthrow Assad? Or is the goal to end the violence as quickly as possible? Because maybe the fastest end to the violence is Assad wins. I don't know. And that's not necessarily advocating a solution where we end the violence by killing everybody who opposes Assad and we're done. This is why it's a difficult problem. And it's why it's so heartbreaking. you know, because you're in a situation where there is a cycle of violence in place. With every single attack, you are decreasing the chances of people just saying, okay, we've had enough, let's stop. Let's stop. Because everybody wants revenge. There are so many of people at this point whose relatives or close friends have been killed. And it's no longer acceptable for them, for the other side, to just stop killing. They want justice. And of course, that's very understandable. I would too. So, you know, people criticize the sort of wait-and-see approach and don't do anything and blah, 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 blah. Going back to George H.W. Bush, you know, wouldn't be prudent. Wouldn't be prudent. Of course, that's actually the parody of George H.W. Bush, not actually George H.W. Bush, but whatever. You got to be really careful. I'm generally very conservative when it comes to intervention kinds of things, and not conservative in the, you know, Mitt Romney kind of way, but in the want to be very careful and only do things when it's the only choice and only do things when there's a very, very high probability of success without the, you know, excessive collateral damage. I'm all for the old-fashioned Powell doctrine, you know, only going in when there's no other choice, with overwhelming force, in a way that you know you're going to succeed. And there's more to the Powell doctrine than that. But and I certainly don't see anything here that can do that. And half measures often end up just making things worse. And so it's a very, very tricky line to tread. And certainly the folks in the administration who are studying this have a lot more information than I do, have a lot more understanding of what's going on the ground. God knows I don't know all that much about Syria. And certainly not all the specifics of what's going on and who's who. And so I hope that it dies down quickly and ends. But I fear that it's going to get worse and worse first. And calls for intervention are going to get more and more. And that maybe there will be some intervention and will end up making things worse instead of better. I don't know. You know, on the other hand, you know, things didn't turn out that horribly in Libya, although they're not great either. I don't know. We'll see what happens. We'll keep watching. Regardless, it's a horribly, horribly sad situation. And watching the reports come out of there is gut-wrenching. And the videos this week were particularly bad. But for those paying attention, it's unfortunately nothing new. Like I said, there have been massive numbers of civilians killed going back for many, many months. Not that it's only the civilians that matter either. The deaths of combatants are just as tragic. Anyway, let's take a break. I think we'll come back and talk about Mitt Romney getting to 1144. We'll be back after this. Bring me the elephant. Bring me the elephant on the stick. 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 And here I am. So, Romney clinched the Republican nomination, got to 1144 by some counts, including mine. By some other counts, he's still got a few more delegates to grab. And of course, nothing's official till the convention, regardless. But it's a milestone. It's a done deal. You know, absent the huge scandal that comes up and causes Romney to drop out or something, which nobody anticipates, we have our nominee. And okay, it was anticlimactic. We've had our nominee for months. You know, as I pointed out on my blog, there was not one single day, not one, from January 1st onward, where Romney was not ahead in delegates. And the only time it was even close was in the few days between Newt Gingrich winning South Carolina and Mitt Romney winning Florida. This was not close. By the time we got to early March, it was clear that of the candidates, the only one who could get to 1144 was Mitt Romney. And by the time we got to early April, it was clear that the other guys weren't going to be able to stop it. Because until then, there was still an off chance that if all the non-Romneys together continued to get a lot of delegates, they could block Romney from getting to 1144 and manage some kind of brokered convention. But by the beginning of April, that was clear that that wasn't going to be the case. And so we've just had April and May with Romney chugging along, getting the delegates he needed. Santorum and Gingrich actually sort of lost delegates during that time period as delegates that they were assumed to be getting through the rest of the caucus processes playing out in caucus states didn't materialize. And Ron Paul actually also gained some delegates, but nowhere near enough to make a difference. But for the most part, it was just a matter of Romney chugging along and getting his delegates. You still hear the occasional thing about the Ron Paul stealth delegates, people who support, who have been elected as delegates for other candidates, but who secretly, actually support Ron Paul. But Ron Paul himself has called for these guys not to make trouble. We're done. So what else is there to say? Not much. You know, for all intents and purposes, the general election campaign already started when Santorum dropped out. No one was even paying attention to Gingrich. For the most part, folks didn't care about Paul. But the interesting thing is the expectation is that Romney would very quickly begin his pivot to the center. Because he'd moved so far to the right in order to get where he needed to in the Republican primaries. The notion was he had to start moving center to start once again appealing to the swing voters, the ones who actually haven't made up their mind yet between Republicans and Democrats. which is a small percentage. But for the most part, that small percentage isn't, or aren't, I should say, people who are going to feel attracted to the heavy conservative message. Because guess what? Those people are already for Romney. It is those central mushy voters who go back and forth and aren't really sure, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of those folks are looking for the reasonable moderate type guy. You know, the guy who looks maybe sort of like what Mitt Romney looked like when he was governor of Massachusetts, maybe. The thing that's interesting, though, is that pivot hasn't really materialized, at least not yet. It seems like Romney is still appealing to his base primarily. And maybe he feels like he still needs to shore up that base and make sure those people are primed to show up when it comes to election day. But those aren't the people he needs to win. I mean, sure, if they don't show up, that's also bad for him. But if he can't appeal to those folks in the middle, it's going to be very tough. Which brings me to another part of this. Yeah, I've been watching some of the election coverage. And because I've been traveling, I've actually watched more cable news than I usually do. And there are folks talking about how close this is. Now, I want to be careful on my verb tenses here. Because before we get to the end, it may well turn out to be a close race. But right now, it is not a close race. Right now, Romney is at a significant disadvantage. I've talked before how if you see a poll about that's national, ignore it. Or take it with a big grain of salt. The national polls have the advantage that they happen more often, and so therefore can pick up changes more quickly, blah, blah, blah. But this is not an election that's based on the national popular vote. It's an election based on smaller elections in 50 states plus the District of Columbia and 5 congressional districts in Nebraska and Maine. If you look at that, which you know I do on a routine basis on my site, abelsmay.com, you'll see it. If you look at how the states are and give Romney give him all the states he's ahead in the polls in, give him all the states that are even close in the polls, not just the ones he's ahead in, but the ones that Obama is ahead in, but not by very much. That still barely gives him enough to win. He has to sweep all of those states to win. He's in a very disadvantaged position coming in right now. Now, as I keep pointing out, there's a lot of time between now and November. And specifically, maybe they're not shaking the Etch-a-Sketch till the convention. I don't know. But at some point, people thought once he wrapped up the nomination, he'll start moving some of those states back in his direction, and he'll start appealing more generally. And for a few weeks, it looked like things were going that direction. There was for about a month, most of the states that were moving towards Romney. And then it seems like that stopped and is starting to get undone. And Romney's now about the same place he was, a month and a half, 2 months ago, which is not a very good place. So when does the move start? I still fully expect that this will get closer before we get to the end. But it's not right now. And that's one of the things I really get annoyed by the media. And I had a Twitter exchange with somebody about this. the one bias that's absolutely reliable across the media is the bias in favor of drama and interesting things going on versus boring. Sure, you'll have, you can build a pretty good case that, you know, MSNBC tilts left and Fox News tilts right, and they spin the news in those directions, and most media outlets have some agenda they're bringing to the table. But the one thing that really is consistent is the bias for the interesting over the boring. And guess what? A close race is more interesting. So you hear all the time, you know, when they start talking about this, even if they bring up the Electoral College, they may show on the screen that Obama's got a significant lead, but then in the verbal conversation about it, they'll sort of dismiss that. They'll mention that there's a lot of time to change. They'll mention whatever, which is fine. I mentioned that there's a lot of time to change. It may still get closer, but they try to hype up the fact that this is a close race. This will be a difficult battle for Obama, blah, 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 blah. And maybe it will be. But right now, it is not a close race. Right now, Obama is way ahead. Right now, Romney has a lot of work to do. And so far, whatever he's been doing in the last month or so hasn't been working. He's still got to choose a VP. He's still got a convention coming up. He's going to be blanketing the ads all over the place. I spent last weekend in Ohio, and look, there really are political ads on TV. You don't see them in Washington State, because Washington State is a heavy blue state. It's not going Republican. No one cares. But if you are in one of those swing states, you're going to be seeing that advertising all the time, and it's going to just be ramping up and ramping up and ramping up. But yeah, lots of people being sloppy, and just if you just look at the numbers, it is not close right now. But like I said, long way to go. It might get close. But I think that's an important distinction that people have to make. The spin should not be, it's a close race. You know, it's a close, hot, hard-fought race. The actual reality right now, Obama's way ahead. What can Romney do to change that? Okay, let's take a break. And we'll come back and we will talk about New York City and sugary drinks. So, sugary drinks. And speaking of this eating kind of stuff, you know, while I was on the trip to Oberlin for the graduation, you know, I wasn't eating very much. There's sort of a weird schedule. All my routines were busted up, and I wasn't eating as much as I usually do. And when I was eating, I wasn't eating all that much, you know, relatively small servings, etc. And I was thinking to myself, you know, I probably lost 5 pounds just from being here for the weekend and not eating all that much. And that was probably an exaggeration, but that, you know, but then of course, now I've been on this multi-day tear of airports and junk food and so anything I may have lost is gone. I'm sure I've gained it all back plus more because I've been eating out every night, at whatever restaurant was available. I've had junk food at the airports. Ooh, bag of chips, you know, whatever. Oops. Anyway, and related to this, of course, is the big sugary drinks. Now, also, I don't think I've mentioned this here on the podcast, but I've been changing my own sugary drink habits. You know, for... this has been on and off, but, like, I did this for a while, and then I stopped for, like, the year before my son was born, and then started again afterwards. I was on, you know, the big sugary drinks from the coffee shops. 20-ounce white chocolate mocha, probably averaged once a day, some days more. Occasionally I'd skip a day. But probably averaged one a day. Those things are big, huge, nothing but a big thing of sugar. And, you know, you've seen occasionally those the sort of dioramas or so that people have done online that show how much actual sugar is in various drinks. So they'll have, like, the can of soda, and next to it is a bag of sugar with the same amount of sugar. And there's a lot of freaking sugar in all of these drinks. Whether you're talking, like, the big drinks at Starbucks, or you're talking soda, or you're talking whatever, there's a lot of freaking sugar in those things. And of course, there's, you know, the tendency that people have talked about Americans are getting bigger, obesity rates are skyrocketing, rates of diabetes are skyrocketing, and that's, of course, the reason that people are like, oh, let's do something about this. Now, on a personal level, a few months ago, I cut out those sugary Starbucks drinks. In fact, I started with cutting out caffeinated beverages. So since February, I have not had a caffeinated beverage of any sort. That's not cutting out all caffeine. I've had chocolate. I've had things like that occasionally. But no coffee, no tea, no caffeinated tea anyway, no soda, no caffeinated soda anyway. I've had a couple of non-caffeinated sodas. And it was remarkably easy. There's the caffeine withdrawal the first couple weeks, but you get past that. But then more recently, I've gone further and said, you know, one, and this is in part, I'll admit, my doctor told me I should do this. You know, but one non-water drink per day. And that's usually orange juice. So I'll have an orange juice in the morning with breakfast, and then the rest of the day, water. Water, 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 water. Anyway, that's me. It's good for me. But New York City is saying, or at least Mayor Bloomberg is proposing, who knows if it'll actually get enacted, regulations basically saying that restaurants and eateries within New York City will not be able to provide anything larger than 16 ounces. Now, I don't believe this affects grocery stores or convenience shops or whatever, so you'll still be able to buy your 2-liter bottle of soda or whatever. But if you're sitting in a restaurant or whatever, or I guess buying anything for immediate consumption, so I guess this probably affects, like, the big gulps at convenience stores or whatever as well. 16-ounce max. You can buy 5 of them if you want. But then the notion of this is just to discourage people from just chugging down the huge sugary drink. Now, and there have been a number of things that have shown that over the last few decades, portion sizes in general have increased. Drink sizes have increased even faster. You know, even 10 years ago, the average drink sizes were much smaller. if you go back many decades, you know, an 8-ounce drink was regular. It was normal. And you certainly wouldn't see these 32, 48-ounce monstrosities. You know, I remember in college there being some kind of 100-ounce drink available at a local convenience store. But it was unusual, and it was like, ooh, look at that. Anyway, those of you who have listened to me for a long time probably aren't surprised that I don't think this is the right way to go. To be clear, I think it would be better if people cut down on the sugary drinks. Like I said, I'm doing it myself. I think the smaller serving sizes are a good way to encourage that, because as much as it doesn't make sense from a purely logical point of view, I am far less likely, if I have to go 16 ounces at a time, to drink more. Like, if you stick a 32-ounce thing in front of me, I'm going to try to finish it. You stick a 16-ounce thing in front of me, I'm going to finish it, and maybe I'll want more, maybe I won't. I probably won't. I'll probably be fine with the 16 ounces and be done, and therefore end up drinking half as much. It does make sense that the smaller portion sizes will encourage less consumption. But I don't think this kind of thing should be mandated. I certainly don't think it should be law. I think people have to take responsibility on their own for what they put into their bodies and what they do or do not eat or drink or whatever. I don't want government mandating things like serving sizes. You know, is there suddenly going to be a black market for large size Coca-Cola drinks in New York City? Tell me this isn't ridiculous. This is ridiculous, right? You know, I understand that in some cases it can be more effective. You know, a government mandate saying you must not do blah may in fact result in less blah. But that doesn't mean it's the right thing to do or it's the right way to get less blah. You know, this is the classic example of, do the ends justify the means? And in almost all cases, my answer to that is no. It's not enough to look at some sort of utilitarian balance and say, if we pick policy A or policy B, which one gets us to the best result in the long run, and therefore that's the policy we're going to pick. You have to look at the mechanism involved. And if the mechanism involved involves coercion and forcing people to do one thing even though they would like to do it a different way, I think the presumption has to be very much against that. Sometimes that may be required. I'm not an absolutist on this. I believe that there are many requirements that make sense and that us as a society can agree on. But I think the presumption should be against us, against that. It should only be done when it's absolutely positively necessary and there is no other choice. This is not one of those cases. You know, I'd say education efforts or whatever might be a better way to go, but I don't really want the government doing that either. You know, if of course, you know, it's not like the big soda makers are going to do that. They want you to drink more of their flavored sugar water, because, you know, they can make a decent penny on that flavored sugar water. But come on. Let's not try to do it by social engineering. At some point, people will realize that this stuff isn't good for them. That, or, you know, it's good only in moderation. Like, every once in a while, have a soda. Cool, go for it. But, you know, you shouldn't be chugging, you know, huge amounts of soda every day, all the time. Duh. Yeah, I know it tastes good. And I spend a lot of time chugging lots of soda every day and lots of those big sugary coffee shop drinks as well. Because they give you a jolt, they give you that sugar high, they give you that caffeine high, whatever, whatever, whatever. But in the end, it's not that great for you. But, you know, let people make up their own freaking minds. And yes, that includes letting people advertise to them, saying how wonderful Coca-Cola will make their life, and that they should drink lots of it. And then people have to make their own decision. And a lot of the time, people will make bad decisions. And that's got to be okay. And yes, I know you can make the arguments that in the end, you know, the higher obesity rates, higher diabetes rates, whatever, end up imposing public costs on everybody. And so people's private consumption does end up being a matter of public interest. And that may be true to a degree, but there's got to be a balance here, and the presumption has to be let people choose what they want on their own, unless there is an overwhelming need to do otherwise. This is not an overwhelming need to do otherwise. This is not a critical situation. This is not someplace where we have no other choice. So, leave the soda drinkers of New York City alone. And meanwhile, I'll continue to drink my water. And I believe that'll be the end of Curmudgeon's Corner for today. As usual, thanks everybody for listening. Email me at abelsmay@abelsmay.com with any questions, comments, thoughts. Tell your friends. Retweet us. Share us on Facebook. All that sort of thing. And I'll be back next week, hopefully with Yvonne, for, you know, after a number of weeks away, a more normal show, where you get to hear the two of us banter about whatever. In any case, have a good week. Talk to you next week. Goodbye. Okay, well, now that's done, and it's time for me to pack up my stuff and head back to the airport for another exciting trip. Hopefully I'll get back to Seattle this time. Off I go!